Kurt Nauk is the proprietor of Nauk's Vintage Records, widely recognized as one of the premier record auction companies in the world. He's currently at work on a project called the American Vintage Record Labelography. This project is being undertaken by collectors, researchers, dealers, and archivists. This labelography is a listing of every 78 RPM and cylinder recording ever issued commercially in the U.S., and Kurt plans to issue this on CD-ROM. Kurt's right here. Please see him if you have any questions or would like to contribute to this effort.
Thank you. Esteemed colleagues, and if you're not steamed yet, you probably will be before I'm finished. Last year I was asked by Phil and Martin if I would consider chairing the dealers committee, which position had been vacant for some time, and I really wasn't in need of one more thing to do. And so I asked them, what does this entail? And they suggested, well, you know, anything that that dealers might be interested in, how you would serve the dealing community within the organization. I said, well, give me some ideas. And they did. And I guess the two ideas that were focused on, not only by those two, but a couple of others on the executive committee that I talked to, were the establishment of a, quote, standardized grading system for vintage recordings. And the second was the establishment of an arbitration panel for disputes between dealers and collectors. Given that choice is kind of like getting dropped into a den of lions. Any way you turn, you're going to get killed. So I figured I picked the path of least resistance and chose the grading project. And that may or may not have been a wise choice, as we may see. But after considering how I would go about pursuing this, I devised the following method of conducting the study. Drawing upon records in my possession, I assembled a group of 55 recordings that represented most major types of 78 RPM discs and virtually every condition that one is likely to encounter. These records also exhibited most of the different types of damage and inherent flaws that one would expect when evaluating old recordings. These records were carefully selected from hundreds of examples that I had in my possession at the time, and they included basically 25 acoustic and roughly 25 acoustic, 25 electric recordings. Once I had graded all of these records myself, I randomly assigned each one a number, which I applied to the record itself, placed them in an unmarked sleeve, and put them inside a large box for shipment. I sent this box of records to 20 of the major vintage record dealers in the United States for their evaluation. And I'm going to read a list of the names of these dealers, and if any of them, I know some are, present this morning, please stand up. These dealers included Martin Bryan, Harry Butler, David Canfield, Jim Cartwright, Gene Earle, Tom Hawthorne, Warren Hicks, Warren Hodgden, Larry Holdridge, Gene Joslin, Brad Kay, Joe Lauro, Dave Norbeck and Jim Peters, Russ Shore, Steve Smolian, Mike Stewart, and Milt Weiss, Don Wetzel, and Pete Whalen. And before I go any further, I want to thank each of those individuals from the bottom of my heart for their participation. This project was started in November. It was to conclude in time for me to give this lecture this morning. And in order for that to happen, considering the length of time it takes to get these things from one dealer to the next, each dealer basically had to grade those records within 3 days and get it right back out to the next guy. And everyone was most cooperative in that respect, and that's why I'm able to give this to you. Packed with the box of 55 records was an instruction sheet, a portion of which I will read to you. Each record has a numbered sticker attached to it in the runoff area. Do not remove it. This number corresponds to a number on the enclosed grading form. The numbers have been randomly assigned and have nothing whatsoever to do with the record or its condition. You are to grade each record just as if it were going to be listed in your own catalog. This is very important. Do not grade any more conservatively or leniently than you normally would, and note only those defects that you would normally describe. Write the overall grade in the first column and any defects you care to mention in the second column. Finally, make any comments you would care to about that particular record. Examples might be, I do not feel qualified to grade a Berliner since I don't deal in that type of material, or I had to play this record in order to properly evaluate it. By its very nature, an empirical grading system can only be devised for a visual system. There are just too many variables involved to quantify an aural system. For this instance, or for this reason, I would ask that you only play the records when absolutely necessary. If you do have to listen to a record in order to grade it, please say so in the comments column. And then with the instruction sheet was a grading form like this with the appropriate columns that each dealer would fill out for the 55 records. And finally, a sheet for general comments on grading and a request for each dealer to let me know what type of light that he used or uses when grading records. Over the next 6 months, this box made its way around the country. Completed grading forms were received from all 20 dealers by mid-May. These results were entered into a computer database, and a method was employed to convert the submitted grades to numerical values ranging from 0, unplayable, to 20, mint. The reason that I went at this particular part of the survey with a 20-point scale was because although most dealers use no more than 20 codes when they were grading, through the uses of combination codes, pluses and minuses and so forth, most dealers actually had a range of grades to draw from that went anywhere from 13 up to almost 20 grades. Now, if I can just find the transparency that I want to show you here.
This may not work. Back this up. You able to read that? Is this okay for the most part? What you see here is on the.
I'll come back over here so everybody can see it. In the left column is a list of labels of each record that was included in the survey. The next column lists the type, that being acoustic or electric for that particular disc. The third column is a general order which I assigned to these records. This does not correspond to the record number that was placed on the record. This is something that I did later. I laid every record outside of the sleeves and compared them in the sunlight to each other and basically sorted them by degree of wear from mint to pothole filler. The next column is basically just some comments that I made that might have affected the way a particular record was graded by an individual. The next three columns were submitted grades by three anonymous dealers in a survey, and that is and has been and will continue to be a very important part of this project. All responses are known only to myself in terms of who made them. That's why for these three columns I picked graders whose nomenclature was the same sort that most people generally use. The last three columns, which is most difficult to see, I guess, are the numerical conversions assigned to the grades of these three dealers. We did, like I say, 20 of these, so I only picked these three. These three dealers, by the way, do not correspond to the first three dealers that received the box of records. They were just randomly selected. having previously determined that the best structure for a grading system would be a 0 to 10 scale, and we can go into that later if you would care to, I attempted to place the survey records on such a scale based on their average grades. Before I get into that, however, I'd like to introduce Mike Sherman to you and have him present the results of his analysis. Mike works for Steve Ivey in Dallas, which is a philatelic numismatic firm which does a huge international business. And Mike is also very much involved in records. He wrote the Collector's Guide to Victor Records, which was up for or nominated for an ARSC Awards for Excellence last year. And he has a background in statistical analysis. So once I completed the table of numerical conversions, I submitted that data to Mike, and he's going to tell you briefly what he did with it.
What you see here down the right side, obviously, once again, are the records. Then proceeding from grader 1 through grader 20 across the top. Okay, you'll see that. Those are the normalized scores that we've given everyone. As Kurt mentioned, every dealer uses their own unique system, whether it's a V and E scale, whether it's a number 1 to 6, whether it, whatever letters and combinations of pluses and minuses are used. The only way, obviously, that you can compare two or three dealers with each other is to normalize things to the 1 to 20 scale, like Kurt mentioned. So here you see basically the raw data laid out on each record. Now, what's critical here in this column here, you'll see the mean. That obviously is just strictly an average, and these records, as you see, are ranked from what records turned out with the highest mean down to the lowest. Now, this is obviously not a course in statistics, so I will try not to scare you too much, but you see STDEV up there, which is standard deviation. That actually, in my opinion, is an extremely important measure, and for those of you not versed in statistics, I will attempt a 30-second explanation of what it is. A record can achieve a mean score, an average score of 10, in a variety of different ways. One way would be for half the graders to give it a 9, and the other half of the graders to give it an 11, okay, thereby averaging 10. Now, if you as a dealer grading records were to grade that record, for example, let's say a 6, that would represent a rather major error in calculating your personal grading accuracy or calculating your grading consistency, because the majority of people that saw it felt that it was either, you know, in the 9, 10, or 11 range. You called it a 6, that puts you way off the beaten track, way away from everyone else. That is somewhat of a severe miss, so to speak. The other way a record can achieve a grade of 10, for example, an average grade of 10, would be for half the dealers to grade it a 5 and the other half to grade it a 15. That would also make it equal a 10. However, there, if you graded it a 6, it's a much less grievous error, because you've only missed, I mean, you've fallen sort of within the normal range of where the guesses were. In other words, the grades were all over the place on that record. That's what you see here in this column. And it's unimportant how the standard deviation is arrived at statistically, but it serves as a measure of dispersion about the mean. In other words, how scattered the dealer's grades are around the mean. I hope that's clear, and I'll be happy to answer any questions about that later. But anyway, this basically shows you the opening raw data, the everyone's individual grade, the mean, and of course the standard deviation. The higher the standard deviation, the more variety of grades there were. There were, you know, 3s, 4s, and there were 12s. That would give you a high standard deviation. A very low standard deviation would imply mostly 15s and 16s, you know, or mostly 7s and 8s, whatever. We can, of course, rank the records by standard deviation from the lowest here up to the highest tier. The highest obviously had a standard deviation of 3.22 on a 20 scale. The lowest was 0.68. This actually, when you rank records like that...
Mike, yeah. The highest actually is not pictured here. This is after we dropped
right,
something.
Right, yeah, thanks for reminding me of that. What these are actually, when you rank them by standard deviation, as this title says, they're from the easiest to the hardest to grade. In other words, a record with a 0.68, such as Atlantic 851, was fairly easy to grade. Everyone agreed that it was pretty close to new. Most people graded at 19 or 20, or their equivalent M- or N- or E++, whatever they did. The records that gave people the most trouble are generally found down here at the bottom. And those you see, once again, there's the fourth grader over gave it a 2, there's a 6. If you're reading the bottom line, you can see a couple of 13s and a couple of 14s. So you see that at least on a quick glance, it looks like the grades ranged all the way from 2 to 14. And that's rather amazing on a 20 scale to be grading a record with that range. Obviously, up top, you see almost every one of these is an 18, a 19, or a 20. I don't think anyone really graded it below 18. Kurt did mention that there was some data that was thrown out. What you often see done in the statistical analysis is data is eliminated from the study, not biased one way or another, but you may take the records with the highest standard deviations out, or the graders that display the highest inconsistency may be removed. That tends to calm the data down, so to speak, and give you a little bit more consistent results and a little bit easier to analyze. And once again, you can what you can ultimately do if you're attempting to evaluate a grader at this point, you would take his miss on a grade. Let's say, for example, that the mean of a record turned out to be an 11, and you as a grader graded an 8. That means you were 3 points off the mean. You saw it as an 8. The average of the 20 dealers saw it as an 11. So you would have a miss factor of 3. Now what I did is I divided that miss factor of 3 divided by the standard deviation. What that does is that lowers the impact of your 3 if you missed by 3 on a record that everyone missed on. Therefore, you can see that the record with a standard deviation of a 3, which was about the highest we got, if you missed by 3 points on that record, your adjusted miss, your adjusted deviation from the mean is really only about 1, because you're dividing by that standard deviation of 3. On the other hand, if you missed by 3 points on that record with a standard deviation of 0.68, in other words, everyone in the whole survey saw it as an 18, 19, or a 20, except you, who saw it as a 15, that's a 3 or a 4 point miss. That is that's tragic. That's a tragic error on that record because you're way off base.
Are you going to publish a list of the most erratic dealers?
Absolutely. In black print. That's a severe miss that should carry a heavy penalty. So when you divide by that 0.68, that will tend to raise that number. So what this is the dealer's adjusted deviations. These are every dealer's misses divided by the standard deviation. For all the records, and once again, when you add them up at the bottom, you see here are the totals. The higher the total, the worse the grader was grading relative to his misses from what the dealer consensus was. Okay.
Let me, on this table as well, these are not the order that the records were shipped in for those graders who are here. It means nothing.
Kurt is very dedicated to maintaining anonymity.
Mike, one other thing, though, is that if you're talking about somebody who has severely undergraded a record, they really have not committed a crime, have they? We're looking for the people that are overgrading.
No, they in a sense haven't. We all very much enjoy getting records in the mail in much better condition than we had expected. On the other hand, that's only because that's the point that you see at that time. If you were aware of the records that you didn't win, that they were in much better condition, and you were bidding according to the condition that they were listed in, you might be very upset. If I won a record that turned out to be E+, and you bid on it thinking it was V+, you're not going to know that unless I tell you and show you the record. But if you find out that information, then you are upset. So being conservative on one hand is good, and it's better than being in the opposite direction, but on the other hand, the ideal is to accurately describe a record. You want people to know exactly what they're bidding on.
Yes, I agree, but the as consumers, we want to be warned against the overgrader. That's the purpose of this.
In rare coins, I face this every day, and I don't know how many of you have ever dabbled in rare coins. I apologize. Don't throw anything. Rare coins is a very tricky business, and grading, if you think grading is tough in records, in coins it's far worse. The value of coins is exponential once you get into very high grade. So there's a lot of controversy surrounding that. And conservatism by itself is not necessarily a virtue. Grading is about communication. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to communicate to someone that can't see the record what it looks like on some normalized scale. It's facilitating communication. What I did here on these misses is I took the absolute value of any miss. So in other words, the negatives and the positives did not cancel out. So if there was a miss of 3 points high or low, it counted as 3 points off the median. 3 points off the median. So you can see down here, grader number two, which is Kurt, which I'll say again, is not the second person that received the records. Apparently did the best with a total deviation of only 26.51, and it ranged up to the upper 40s, I believe. There's a 46 over.
Again,
here.
This doesn't include all 20, does it?
No, this includes, I believe there are, how
18.
Many are here? 18, I think. Even though there's 19 shown in this corner, we eliminated five, number five, for example, and there may have been some others.
Number 20.
So there were two graders that were taken out. These last things are charts, and this just will show you a little bit about Kurt had developed his scale based on absolute wear. In other words, looking in the sunlight, laying the records out, lining them up from most worn to least worn.
Using the worst side when there was a discrepancy.
That is the dotted line. The solid line is the rank by average grade given by the 20 dealers. So you see Atlantic 851 here at the corner ranked first. That was the top, nicest record, least worn. This Berliner here on the other side, which you probably can't see, was ranked 48th on this chart. But once again, there were 55 records, but we did throw out some records with severe defects that tended to really skew the numbers. So you can see that there are certain records that fall pretty much along the scale. There are others that the actual grade given by the dealers was not really in proportion to wear. That would imply that there's something else going on the record, which I'm sure Kurt will get into later. And finally, just as something because it was late at night, my printer was anxious to work, I ran off bunches of these charts here. These are for each individual grader. You can see the solid line here is the mean at which the record was graded from best to worst. Once again, you see down here our friend Atlantic 851, which everyone pretty much felt merited a 19.6 or thereabouts, all the way down to the Berliner, which once again we used for pothole filler, which I think ranked about an average of one. The dotted line is greater one's particular grade that he gave relative to the average. You can see that he tended to be a little bit liberal right in here, towards the high side, very conservative on this one particular record, but generally tending towards the liberal side and missing by a pretty fair amount. That was an example of probably one of the average, maybe slightly below average graders. The grader that won was grader number two, and you'll see a fairly tight distribution about everyone's mean. You see, once again, this solid line is the same line you saw in grader one, but grader two, you see, is neither conservative nor liberal, is you know, was a little on the liberal side here, a little on the conservative side here, but no big misses here, maybe 2 or 3 points at most, and stuck pretty close to the mean, was actually very accurate. So, given all the standard deviations and all the means and all the averages and things like that, that brings us back to Kurt. And he will discuss what we're going to do with all this.
So after I got the results back from Mike, I then took the actual records. And I sorted them in order by the average, mean, as you saw on the table that Mike showed you, from the record that average grade was the best to the record that the average grade was the worst. From that group, I then assumed that I would just go through and pull out the 1, the 2, the 3, the 4, the 5, and so forth, and this would be our benchmark scale for the grading system. But when I did that, I found that the 4 was better than the 6, or the 8 was better than the 5, or whatever. The results were entirely skewed. There was such chaos, if you will. I spent 3 hours on this, going through every conceivable combination. I grouped the major condition records in like 6 or 7 groups and tried to pick out a representative example from each one. And I went through everything that you could think of to try and establish some sort of sense out of the data that had been provided to me. But it was simply impossible to do. I was left with a choice. Either I could provide a standardized system, which was poor and basically unusable, and yet stick to the data and the method, or I could say, well, the data and the method is useful to see that we need a standardized system, but in order to establish some type of a standardized system, we're going to have to do something else. And it would do no one any good to use the data as presented and try and cram that into a space that we could then use to grade our records with. Nobody would use it. If this study proved anything, it demonstrated just how great a need there is for a standardized system of grading. If 20 of the nation's best known, established, and reputable dealers could not agree on what condition these 55 records were in, imagine what sort of hodgepodge would be derived by including every other vintage record auctioneer in the survey. I presented the results of this project to the executive committee on Wednesday, and I have been, I don't know if it's based on what I've done or not, but reassigned the chairmanship of the dealers committee. I had come in at half term anyway, so. And what I proposed is to pursue this project in the following manner. Using the information that we've shown you as a guide, taking what I can from it. And there is valuable information, and there's a lot of things that we have not talked about at all yet. And using some of the records included in the survey, I will then go to records that I have in my possession and actually pull out a 0 to 10 scale, which gives us basically 11 points, and pick records, trying to keep as close to the survey results as possible, to represent each point on that scale, picking 11 records which show a degree of wear with no defects whatsoever, just wear. This is the wear that you could expect a number 3 record to display, and then picking another record, a number 3 for instance, that has roughly the number and types of defects that you might expect to see on a record displaying that sort of wear. In other words, if a record's very worn, generally it's going to also have some scratches and, you know, edge flakes and label scuffs and so forth. There's a point at which those are not described on a lower graded record. On a mint record, anything is described. On a unplayable record, you assume that it, you know, looks like a frisbee, so you don't worry about that. It just takes up catalog space. This would give us 22 records. Once these were assembled, then this box of records will be shipped again to the 20 dealers for their input, not for them to grade, but just to look at and see if they would basically agree that these records do indeed follow a wear pattern which is roughly evenly distributed and would serve as legitimate benchmarks for this type of a study. And if we gain a general consensus on that point, then that is ultimately what I propose that we would use. And there may be one or two records or whatever, however many, that may need to be substituted for whatever reason. That is what I'm going to be doing over the next several months. So here's notice to you dealers that you're not quite finished yet. Let me also stress that when I first contacted these dealers, I told them this was not in any way something which is meant to replace what they're doing. This is not to provide any type of a conflict or cause for alarm on the part of dealers out there. If you guys want to continue to use the systems you've been using, that's fine. And probably most, if not all of you, will. I understand that, and I understood that at the time. We're not trying to establish a code by which ARCE is going to go around as a policing organization saying, you're not using our system, therefore you're not an ARCE-approved dealer, or some kind of nonsense like that. Most dealers, especially those who have been in the business for many years, have a system that their bidders understand. They roughly know if they're good bidders, poor bidders, conservative bidders, liberal bidders, and hopefully there's some consistency there, so if they say that this record is V+, the bidder knows that what a V+ record from that dealer is going to look like. And so there may be little reason for a dealer to even want to switch to a system. And that's why when I use the word standard, it's kind of, for lack of a better term, what I'm trying to do here for the association, with the approval of the executive committee, is to establish a system of grades by which any individual, dealer, or participating archival institution could use in order to grade their records against an established scale to better be able to communicate with someone else, some other institution that they may be doing business with. Basically, especially as far as the rest of the record collecting and dealing world is concerned, this is an in-house sort of thing. This is an ARSC system devised for use by ARSC members if they care to. If the system is good, it will stand, and if not, it will fall. But it will be based upon the merits of the system. Now, many of you, well, before I go on to this briefly, are there any questions, general questions covering what we've already talked about? Mike?
I've noticed that you've been very careful in the latter part of your talk to discuss the fact that you were really mainly looking at wear.
Right.
There's another factor which some people would say it's more important, of course, with records that are in nearly new condition. But it's something that I find most of the popular dealers don't always pay much attention to, and a few of the classical dealers do, and that is a factor of the shellac. Its original inherent noise when it was originally manufactured, and then also the noise that has grown in the shellac, such as was originally discussed in the John Stratton article, Crackle, the IRS published in the late 50s, where this is a problem that really is very,
okay,
very important.
Well, let me address that.
Well, just to mention that sometimes a record that looks nearly new,
right,
can sound horrible just because of the shellac that's present.
We all understand that. That's why I mentioned earlier that the aural side of this has to be virtually disregarded. There comes a point when a dealer or whatever, a collector, needs to understand that a mint Berliner is not going to same sound as a mint Vivatonal. It's not going to same sound as a mint 1929 Victor, due to the very thing, the nature of the records that you're talking about. There does have to be some degree of knowledge on the part of the buyer. Now, that's only gained through experience. It may sound great on my system if I'm using a 2.5 mil truncated elliptical stylus on an SME turntable and a Technics or SME tone arm on a Technics turntable played through my AL filters and my Macintosh amp and my great speakers. But for the guy who's playing on his Victor II, you know, it's going to be totally different. You cannot, and not only that, my ears are going to hear. I shot for 7 years on a rifle team. I'm not hearing what you're hearing anyway. You can't do that. There's got to be some knowledge on the part of the buyer. We're talking about a visual system. If a record plays better or worse than its level of wear would indicate, then the dealer is free to make note of that. The record plays better.
And that is that the shellac, let's say like an HMV, if it has been stored in a good dry condition, has not grown the crackle. But
I included records in this survey that showed varying degrees of graininess in the record material based on the levels of humidity and so forth that record had been subjected to, because I included all types of defects because I wanted to see how dealers would describe them and how it would impact the grade for that particular record. And the results of that are amazing. Let me just put a couple of transparencies up right quick, which show how some of these defects were handled.
Okay, I just picked a few of the records. Record number 12, deck 1521, had a huge blister on it, probably 15 grooves or so, which could cause a light tone arm to skip. And you can see that virtually every dealer picked up on that and described it. However, there were some records here that had hair cracks that maybe only three guys noticed, okay? There were other really severe defects, pressure marks, heavy graininess in the grooves, that maybe half of them mentioned and half didn't. For instance, in the defect summary, you can look and see that record number 28, which had a hair crack, 10 people found. 12 people described heat damage on that record. Doesn't necessarily mean, however, that it was the same group of people, you know. So in all of this, lights please, affected the
way that grader graded a record. We had a record in the survey which was basically in very nice condition, say E condition on average, but it had a chip that extended to 18 grooves, rendering it totally unplayable. Well, the more accurate, well, let me not say that. Some dealers said E record chip to 18 grooves. Other records said V minus minus. They incorporated that defect. It didn't accurately describe the record. I mean, for instance, if I wanted the record for a label, an E record with a chip to 18 grooves may not be too important to me. But if I see V minus minus, I'm going to assume that I probably can't even read the label. Again, it's a matter of communication. We need to break now. Is it time? Okay. Let me... Before I take any more questions, what I'll do is when I finish, anybody who wants to stay behind and ask some questions and talk about this, you're welcome to until the next program starts, for that matter. And Mike has laid out some of the records in the survey on the table just so you can get an idea of what was included. But I want to bring one very important matter to your attention, most of which you're probably already familiar with. In the last issue of Joslin's Jazz Journal, there was an editorial. And this editorial was written without my prior knowledge or consent. Not that it would have required my consent, but it would have been nice to have known that it was coming. And I'm going to read part of it to you. This is a front page editorial. It was written by their editor, Gene Joslin. "The never overly placid waters of record grading are bestirred these days by a project of ARSC, the organization involved with the preservation of recorded sound. For reasons as yet unclear, ARSC has undertaken to put together a standardized grading system for vintage records." What? In the immortal words of hundreds of collector dealers, who asked them? With all respect to ARSC, and there are many notable collectors, dealers, researchers in that group, where have they been? Can it be that too many hours in musty archives have cut them away from the passing parade? By my recollection, our present standard grading system has been around much longer than ARSC and is doing fine. Such problems as do arise are not from inadequacies of the grading standards, but in their application by individuals, whether through mistake or intent. You have to wonder about the self-anointed presumption of whoever decided the Arsk should undertake this crusade. One point made by Kurt Nauck, who is in the not altogether enviable position of implementing this Arsk project, is that operatic and classical collectors have their own grading conventions and would take offense if their standards were to be relegated to obscurity. So, what about our standards? Are we to rattle the pillars of what has evolved as a consistently dependable grading system over nearly 50 years known all over the civilized world? Let's not let come lately committees tamper with a well-established and well-working grading system. If there is enough misunderstanding in the world as it is, let's not add record grading chaos to the unfortunately long list. I didn't. There were certain parts I left out. My response to this initially was to call Gene. He is a friend of mine still. He is a member of the panel which graded these records and had been informed before the project began of what was going on, and his help was enlisted, and it was graciously given. I, after having discussed this with him for some time, I think perhaps he was a little bit upset that he had written quite in this vein. He has graciously allowed me the second page of his next issue for a rebuttal, and that's already basically composed. But what I did was, I didn't want to just, you know, make general comments that are just going to cause nothing but more confusion. I took the 10 or 11 graders who participated in this survey who claimed to use the Joslin's Jazz Journal / Vintage Jazz Mart jazz record grading system, which was derived from the old record changer system in the 1940s. Let's see if they agreed. I will put you their responses
on the overhead.
It would take more time than we have here to really look at this, but they're not consistent either. And anybody who's bid and been successful in any of the auctions in these two publications knows that a V-plus record in this guy's list is not the same as a V-plus record in that guy's list. I have a table made out of different auctioneers that says, don't bid on anything below E-minus in this guy's list. Don't bid on anything below V-plus in this guy's list. There is not standardization. There is, for the most part, standardization in nomenclature, but that's where it ends. And even that is of dubious value. Is there any one of us who would really want our collection to be made up of very good records, V condition records, or good? I mean, good is, who? Nobody wants good. The editorial was very valuable because it caused me to think about some things I hadn't thought before. I went to Vintage Jazz Mart and I went to Joslin's Jazz Journal. I pulled out their stated grading definitions, the codes they use, the definitions that they use. And you'll notice that they are not the same. And they're very much subjective. One record, the wear on this record causes moderate surface noise. What does that mean? For reasons we've already described, it really means very little. These two tables are going to be part of my rebuttal when I send that in to Gene. That it's a quarterly publication, so it won't be coming out for some time. I'm also writing a detailed report with much more information than I've been able to give here for the Arsk Journal that will be published in the next issue, and will include a number of these tables as well. Yes.
The Joslin grading code has something which has concerned me and probably concerns a lot of other people, that is having a category for unplayed records. How can anyone at this point in time determine if a record's never been played, and should that code be used?
I have only ever seen one record that I knew to be unplayed that was a 78. It's because they packaged it in a cellophane. That's it. There is no way to determine that a record is unplayed. unplayed would not come into our system that I'm deriving. No, no way. You could say it appears unplayed, but that's as far as you could go with it. In my catalog, I don't use N for new. I use N minus. And most dealers who participate in the survey, only one or two actually use an M or an N grade. Everybody else went up to a point, but they never did actually use the top code when describing 78s.
I'd be willing to bet that nearly everyone in this room will applaud the project that's underway right now. Certainly the editorialist is going way out on a limb. I would only argue that the project will not be complete until there's been some very close study of the correlation between the way these records look and the way they sound. Most of us collectors are interested in what we hear. We're interested in knowing if the record is audibly off-center in its pressing, or if the noise level increases toward the end of a side. Of course, there's subjectivity involved, but all these aspects...
Well, that is the purpose of additional description in terms of defects, if a record's off-center or what have you. Let me make one more point, which is extremely important. Any system is worthless if it only consists of printed words on a page. I can't do any better than Joslin's or Vintage Jazzmart. My catalog is patterned after what they've done. It's the best that there is to date. There will not be a standardized system. It cannot be unless there is a visual element with it. And what I have proposed to the executive committee, based on our ultimate results, is that a monograph be published, with each of these 22 records pictured. A person can hold up a record and compare it to the picture and see, for the most part, where that record's going to fall, with little argument, give or take a point. That removes a high level of subjectivity, and that's going to really make whatever standard eventually comes up with that type of a pictorial system, make it usable. So that's ultimately where I see us headed. We're going to go ahead and stop now for the coffee break, and then anybody who wants to talk further may do so. Thank you.
I think everyone's incredibly riveted.